7. Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, July 2, 1776, 5 p.m. Thomas Jefferson will soon commit treason. Thick clouds of horseflies fill the assembly room as Congress finally ends its second consecutive long day of debate. The time has now come to cast a vote for or against independence from England. The weather outside is hot and sultry, forcing custodian Andrew McNair to open the tall windows to let in a breeze, but with the fresh air come the horseflies, courtesy of a stable next door. The flies swarm the cloth-covered tables, biting the delegates through the thin stockings covering their lower legs. 1 week ago, Jefferson submitted his version of the Declaration of Independence for review by his peers. He is proud of his way with the written word and the elegance with which he crafted the document. The Virginian believes that his declaration has a clear voice and makes a compelling argument for freedom. Yet he knows that the outcome doesn't belong to him. The case he makes for independence will be scrutinized by congressional subcommittees, which will dissect his words line by line and make their own changes. Jefferson is not at all happy about this upcoming edit, particularly from men whose writing skills are not his equal. But that is part of the frustrating business of Congress. Every action must be put to a vote, no matter how petty or insignificant it might seem. The vote at hand, however, is obviously different. Within moments, the term colony may no longer define the territories these men represent. Yet a simple majority will not carry the day. By rule of this Congress, all 13 colonies must unanimously choose independence. If just one votes nay, there will be no declaration. Jefferson's 3 weeks of careful writing will have been wasted. Each colony is allowed to cast one vote. However, the number of representatives at the Congress is based upon the size of the territories, so there are more representatives for New York than, say, Delaware. Thus, the majority within each colonial delegation decides which way it will vote. Many are split. Each of the men in this room love America, but not all are convinced that a break from England is best. Yesterday, as thunder hammered Philadelphia and a driving rain pelted the assembly room windows, Pennsylvania's John Dickinson delivered a lengthy argument to the Congress, stating that a vote for independence was premature. It was Dickinson who led the movement 1 year ago to send George III the Olive Branch petition, promising full support for British superiority in the colonies. The king refused to accept, let alone endorse, the document, but Dickinson has not let go of his loyalty. A separation from England, he told Congress yesterday, would invite an attack by Spain or France, or, worst case, might even cause a civil war between the colonies themselves. So yesterday, when it came time for each delegate to cast his vote, the pale and painfully thin Dickinson stood up and stated his choice. Nay. Three other members of the 7-delegate Pennsylvania contingent cast a similar vote. Benjamin Franklin was among the dissenters on the losing side. In all, 9 colonies voted in favor of independence. 2 delegations, South Carolina and a deeply divided Pennsylvania, voted against. Footnote. The 4 South Carolina delegates were originally ordered by the governor and his advisers to vote against independence because they hoped for reconciliation with Britain. But these instructions were rescinded as patriotic fervor grew. Thus, it was somewhat surprising that on July 1st, the South Carolinian delegation got cold feet, still believing that independence was premature, and decided to vote no. End footnote. Delaware split its vote 1-1. The colony actually has 3 delegates, but the thin, cancer-ridden Caesar Rodney is not in Philadelphia due to obligations with his colony's militia. New York abstained, its delegates clearly fearful of an English occupation. Should they vote in favor of independence only to have the British capture New York, they will certainly be put to death. South Carolinian Edward Rutledge, who at age 26 was the youngest member of Congress, requested a second and final vote the following day, in the hope that the members of his delegation could be swayed to change their minds. Now, as the Congress prepares to take its final vote, Jefferson cannot help but notice that a new momentum fills the room. Last night, as many delegates were drinking at the city tavern, footnote, in an era before there was such a thing as hotels, City Tavern on 2nd Street was what many delegates chose as their lodgings while serving in Congress. 3 stories tall, with spacious meeting and drinking areas where the members could debate politics, it was described by John Adams as the most genteel tavern in America. The 2nd Continental Congress had a standing reservation for a dinner for all delegates every Saturday night. City Tavern was leveled in 1854, then meticulously rebuilt by the National Park Service in 1975 in time for America's bicentennial. It is still a thriving business. End footnote. The news arrived from New York that more than 100 British warships now filled the harbor. It is, in fact, the largest invasion force of the century, an assemblage of men and warships designed by King George to crush the rebel movement. Hearing that devastating news, John Dickinson made a bold statement. Still unwilling to vote for independence, but knowing that the future of the nation depended upon a unanimous vote, he has stayed home. Rather than debate this matter in Congress, Dickinson has now chosen to fight the British as a member of the Pennsylvania militia. His conscience will not allow him to vote for independence, but that same conscience cannot endure the wholesale slaughter of American patriots. Dickinson's defection from the vote means that Pennsylvania is no longer aligned with the king. For Thomas Jefferson, independence is the only choice. This is not an emotional decision, but one based on his belief that all men are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, in his own words. All men, that is, except slaves. Footnote: slavery was legal and condoned in all 13 colonies, but by 1776, only Georgia and South Carolina still allowed the importation of slaves. Many members of Congress, including Thomas Jefferson, not just owned slaves, but also sold them as a form of commerce. However, the issue of slavery was making many Americans uncomfortable. One of them was Jefferson. He blamed King George for bringing slavery to America. His original language in the Declaration Concerning Freedom caused considerable debate in Congress, particularly from Georgia and South Carolina. It was later modified to avoid the slavery issue. The congressional delegates deleted the following paragraph. "He, George III, has waged cruel war against human nature itself, violating its most sacred rights of life and liberty in the persons of a distant people who never offended him, captivating and carrying them into slavery in another hemisphere or to incur miserable death in their transportation thither. This piratical warfare, the opprobrium of infidel powers, is the warfare of the Christian King of Great Britain. Determined to keep open a market where men should be bought and sold, he has prostituted his negative for suppressing every legislative attempt to prohibit or restrain this execrable commerce. And that this assemblage of horrors might want no fact of distinguished dye, he is now exciting those very people to rise in arms among us, and to purchase that liberty of which he has deprived them by murdering the people on whom he has obtruded them, thus paying off former crimes committed against the liberties of one people with crimes he urges them to commit against the lives of another." Although those words disappeared from the Declaration of Independence, Jefferson kept them in his private library. End footnote. Jefferson believes that power is achieved by overwhelming argument. Thus, he has chosen to begin the Declaration of Independence by using reason to state what must be done. When, in the course of human events, it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve the political bands which have connected them with another, and to assume among the powers of the earth the separate and equal station to which the laws of nature and of nature's God entitle them, A decent respect to the opinions of mankind requires that they should declare the causes which impel them to the separation. The Virginian is proud of these words. He crafted them knowing that King George might himself someday read them, and that the hope for colonial independence depended upon their precision and logic. But he is also aware that they are just words on a piece of paper. Unless Congress casts a unanimous vote in favor of independence, the king will prevail. Despite the small breeze blowing through the open windows, the muggy Philadelphia heat is intense. Jefferson, who methodically grooms himself with a washcloth each morning, now sweats through his linen shirt and cravat. Footnote: the modern practice of bathing or showering by submersion was not widely practiced in America until the 19th century. For this reason, the room for conducting daily ablutions was known as a privy instead of a bathroom. In the absence of flush toilets, an individual either used a chamber pot or an outdoor privy. For the latter, it was necessary to dig a trench deep into the ground outside a building for use as a toilet, line the hole with bricks, then fit a wooden seat over the opening. Bathing in 1776 consisted of cleaning the face and hands with a cloth wetted in a small wash basin in one's bedchamber. Once the act of cleansing by submersion in water eventually became a common practice, there was a great debate over whether cold or hot water was better for the body. Cold water bathing was considered a form of personal strength, while the use of warm water was seen as a sign of indulgence. End footnote. His coat and vest are not snug on his lank, lean frame, but the summer humidity makes them feel heavy against his skin. It is likewise for the other delegates, some of whom use the excuse of slipping away to use the congressional privy at Fifth and Chestnut to make a quick stop at a local tavern. John Hancock calls for a final vote on independence. Jefferson is focused, his quill pen poised to take his usual careful notes. Secretary Charles Thompson calls the roll, beginning with the delegation from New Hampshire. Suddenly, Delaware Representative Caesar Rodney strides into the room. Footnote: the story of Rodney's ride to Philadelphia is cloaked in mystery. There is disagreement about the moment Rodney arrived, whether he rode in a carriage or on horseback, and the specific route he followed from Dover to Philadelphia. In John Adams, historian David McCullough gives the moment of Rodney's arrival as roughly 9 a.m. when the doors to Congress were about to be closed so the session might begin. End footnote. His boots are spattered in mud, his riding coat drenched with rain. Rodney is an odd-looking man. In the words of John Adams, he is tall, thin, and slender as a reed, pale. His face is not bigger than a large apple, yet there is sense and fire, spirit, wit, and humor in this countenance. When Rodney received word at midnight about the split Delaware vote, he saddled a horse and rode 80 miles, braving lightning and cloudbursts, determined to break the tie in his delegation. Rodney is pale and hungry. His face is ravaged by the cancer in his jaw that is slowly killing him. Too exhausted to stand, he is led to the Delaware delegation's table and slumps into a high-backed chair to await his turn. State by state, Thompson calls the roll. The assembly room is otherwise silent. Each of the state's delegates stands when his name is called. New Hampshire immediately votes in favor of independence. Then Georgia. When Delaware is called to cast its vote, Delegate Thomas McKean helps Rodney to his feet. McKean has cast a vote in favor of independence once again. George Reed of Delaware has again voted no. Rodney breaks that tie. The midnight rider may be on the verge of collapse, but he cannot help but stray beyond a simple aye or nay in casting his historical vote. As I believe the voice of my constituents and all sensible and honest men are in favor of independence, Rodney states clearly, my own judgment concurs with them. I vote for independence. Pennsylvania then votes aye. Delegate Robert Morris has joined John Dickinson by failing to attend the session. In their absence, Benjamin Franklin guides the Pennsylvania vote. In a surprising effort to align themselves with the majority and make the declaration unanimous, South Carolina changes its vote. New York once again abstains. This loyalist stronghold is the most important British colony in America. With 12 votes for and 0 votes against, the decision is considered unanimous. Charles Thompson carefully tabulates the votes. Thomas Jefferson sits just a few feet away as the secretary hands the results to Hancock. The president of the Second Continental Congress then reads them aloud. "Resolved," the record will read, "that these United Colonies are and of right ought to be free and independent states, that they are absolved from all allegiance to the British Crown, and that all political connection between them and the state of Great Britain is and ought to be totally dissolved." The assembly room explodes in cheers. The excited delegates rise as one to congratulate one another on this historic moment. John Adams, the man who dreamed of independence long before it was considered practical, writes home to his wife Abigail in Boston. "Ought to be commemorated as the day of deliverance by solemn acts of devotion to God Almighty. It ought to be solemnized with pomp and parade, with shows, games, sports, guns, bells, bonfires, and illuminations from one end of this continent to the other, from this time forward, forevermore." Footnote: Adams' vision proved to be true, but not on the date the Bostonian intended. The July 2nd vote for independence was a poorly kept secret in Philadelphia, with the delegates trying to keep it quiet until the final wording of the Declaration of Independence could be approved. This took place on July 4th, which is why that is now considered America's Independence Day. End footnote. Thomas Jefferson, his vision validated, breaks his usual stoicism. A broad smile crosses his face as he shakes the hand of Benjamin Franklin. The two men are not personally close, but have deep respect for each other. John Hancock pounds his gavel to restore order. 31 days later, at 9 a.m. on August 2nd, Thomas Jefferson bears witness as his Declaration of Independence is formally signed by the members of Congress. News about the vote severing America's relationship with England has ricocheted around the colonies. Printed copies of Jefferson's final document have been read aloud in public squares near and far. The people of Philadelphia have used it as an excuse for bonfires and hard drinking. In New York, after George Washington reads it aloud to his troops, an excited mob tears down the oversized statue of King George in Lower Manhattan. The monument is then melted down and the lead formed into thousands of musket balls, which will be fired upon the British as they fight the Americans for control of New York City. Despite the revelry, Thomas Jefferson is still anxious. He is eager to leave the Congress to be with his wife Martha, who has become very ill. And the Virginian is hardly pleased at what Congress has done to his original declaration. Their line-by-line rewrite is so tedious in Jefferson's estimation that he has printed out his own original version to show friends as a reminder of how the declaration should have read. Footnote: Jefferson will not publicly take credit for writing the declaration for more than 20 years. End footnote. There is nothing, however, that Jefferson can do about that now. It is time to formally sign the Declaration of Independence. John Hancock signs first, in a big, looping script so large that many will joke that he was trying to ensure that King George can read his name without the use of glasses. One by one, the other delegates step forward. They sign north to south, right to left, so that the last delegation to sign is that of Georgia. Thomas McKean is the last man to put his name on the document. The process is informal, with some men signing illegibly, such as Thomas Hayward Jr. from South Carolina. Others, such as Samuel Adams from Massachusetts, sign their common name. In Adams's case, His signature will go down in history as just Sam Adams. When it comes his turn to sign, Jefferson rises and stands in line directly behind Richard Henry Lee, the man who began the process by proposing independence on June 8th. Lee signs in the fourth column. Jefferson takes a pen and affixes his signature directly below Lee's, forever aligning them as fellow Virginians at a moment in time that will change the world. Each man who signs has just committed an act of treason against the crown. His life, family, and property are now in dire jeopardy. In time, the British will ride to Monticello in search of Thomas Jefferson, and those fears will be realized. Right now, though, the prospect of terror is secondary to Jefferson's anguish over Martha. He will find himself bereft throughout the month of August, desperate to return to her side. Finally, as September arrives, Jefferson can take no more. His work here is done. He resigns from the Congress and rides home to Martha. But for the warriors who must risk their lives in battle to see Jefferson's vision become reality, the struggle for independence has just begun.